This is a show about possibilities. Stop running from the negatives. Start focusing on the positives. Manage the unmanageable. Let Dan help. This is the Thank You Dan Show with Alex. Now, here's Dan Gasby.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Thank You Dan.
And Alex Show.
Alex, you know, there are times when you do things that you feel very proud of, and there are times when you just say to yourself, I'm the luckiest man in the world. And today, I feel very lucky and very special because we're going to have a special show today, a show that is directed towards the thing that I feel is the most important, underrated organ of the body that most people take for granted, and that's the brain.
Yes, indeed. That is the brain, Dan.
And what makes me feel even more proud about this special show on the Thank You, Dan and Alex show is one of those times when, you know, I feel when B got Alzheimer's, I said to myself, I wanted to make a difference. And I read up a lot of information about Alzheimer's and dementia. And then I didn't understand that there are so many more diseases that are attributed to what happens when the brain is not right, when it's in disrepair. And that led me to getting involved with this organization that we're going to devote the entire show to, the ABF, the American Brain Foundation.
Yes.
And I am on the board. I'm very proud of that fact. And I've come to meet some amazing people, amazing doctors who are doing things in so many different categories. And one of the people, although she's not a doctor, is the executive director. Would you introduce her?
I would love to, and we're very excited to have Jane Ransom with us today. Jane, you are the executive director of the American Brain Foundation. Welcome.
Hey, Jane.
Well, thank you, Dan and Alex. I'm really pleased to be here.
We are so happy to have you, and it's always great to talk to you and learn something new, because there's always something we can still learn from you.
What made you decide to join the Brain Foundation?
It's both personal and there's a bigger picture motivation, too. I mean, the personal motivation is just like both of you and everyone I know. Everyone has someone, a friend or a loved one, or maybe it's themselves, that has a brain disease. It's when you add together all the brain diseases, from glioblastoma to autism to Parkinson's to Alzheimer's, it's a much bigger thing than cancer, and yet we're not treating it that way. So I'm just like everyone else. I have a mother with a really bad dementia, badly, you know, developed over the years. I have a friend with multiple sclerosis. I have had a friend die from ALS. My son went through a horrible period with a concussion. So, you know, it's personal for me, and that inspires me. But the other thing that inspires me and inspired me to get involved is history. I'm a history buff, and we know, looking at history, that the American people have taken down certain diseases. I mean, by getting organized, by giving money, we've been able to basically beat polio. We've been able to put HIV/AIDS on its heels so that it's a treatable condition and not a killer, you know, a lethal killer. We've been able to do this. We've been able to get people to stop smoking. You know, when we get together around a medical issue, we're able to push back and make a real difference, and we can do this with brain disease. So I'm inspired by that American history, too, of beating back really bad diseases.
Right. And so the American Brain Foundation brings researchers and the public together, right, Jane? Is that what would you do?
That's exactly right, Alex. We bring researchers and the public together to cure brain diseases and disorders. So, you know, with the public, that means, you know, creating this into a cause, a bigger cause called Cure Brain Disease, and getting people to give, just like we gave, those of us who are older, put pennies in cans that were passed around in movie theaters during the time of polio. Mm-hmm. We get together and raise money and then work with the researchers to understand where that money should go, where can we make the biggest difference in funding for research.
So why do you think, Jane, it has taken so long to really create substantial funding for the brain? What has taken so long that the brain has really become recognized to really start something for fundraising and research and all these things? Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are organizations that have built some very strong funding and research funding around specific different brain diseases that I certainly would credit them that they've been doing this for quite a while around Alzheimer's, around ALS, around multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's. There are all different societies and organizations for each of those diseases. But I think it's only now that we're starting to see the big picture that these diseases are interconnected. You know, they have, many of them have a common biology. So what we say at the American Brain Foundation is if you can cure one, you can cure many. An example of this is involved in Lewy body dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and Parkinson's disease is a protein called tau that gets tangled up and causes degeneration of the neurons in your brain. That is a major underlying factor in all of those diseases. It's not just that there's going to be one cure for Alzheimer's, one cure for Parkinson's. If we can break through on tau, we may be able to make substantial inroads, if not cures, on all of those diseases that include the tau tangle.
Why do you think it's been so difficult thus far for people? I know the beta amyloid plaque sort of ignites the tau, and the tau is what, as you so aptly said, kills the neurons, which break down the messaging that goes from one part of the brain to the other. Why do you think it's so difficult to find some sort of amelioration or remedy?
Well, I think it's I think that we haven't been at it that long. I was talking the other day to the president of the American Academy of Neurology, who's been, you know, in business as a practical private practice neurologist for probably 40 years. And he said, you know, it used to be diagnose and adios. So, I mean, the neurologist was seen and they saw themselves as people that didn't really have much to give to the patient. I think it's probably only in the last 30 or 40 years that things have really taken off in research on these various brain diseases. And so there's some catching up to do. And I think that, you know, I think maybe culturally we just thought these diseases were inevitable and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, when I was growing up, we called people senile,
right,
that were too old. Probably,
yeah,
you know, a huge,
exactly,
percentage of them had Alzheimer's disease.
Well, they called Alzheimer's Alzheimer's, even though it was named after Aldous Alzheimer, who saw after doing an autopsy, saw the plaque in the brain. But
right,
people sort of, you know, I guess, and you tell me because you're the expert, I guess they sort of thought, resigned themselves as just was going to be
old
part
age
of growing old. Yeah.
That's right. I think that's exactly what they did. Mm-hmm. And so I think that still hangs over us, that cultural sort of way of looking at things hangs over us. I think, you know, when you've got like a whole ton of baby boomers getting older, there's more urgency around Alzheimer's now than there used to be, because we all know I'm a baby boomer. I'm a baby boomer.
I think Alex is right at the
I'm at the cusp.
She's at the cusp of boomer. She's still a baby. She's not a boomer yet, you know?
She's not the greatest generation.
Yeah. That was our parents.
I know. I think now we're all seeing our parents go through this, and we know that a huge percentage of us are going to be hit with it. And so that's helping to, make this a more urgent issue as well.
And you were saying parents, Jane, and obviously not just our parents anymore. The big problem here is also, the staggering numbers, but also the early onset of these diseases, which really creates a tremendous problem for society in general.
That's right. I mean, I don't really have my numbers in front of me for this, but there are studies showing, the great expense to society in the caretaking, not just of Alzheimer's, but in diseases like multiple sclerosis, in the loss of employment. I just read a study this morning, or looked at the headline at least, about cluster headaches and how people with cluster headaches miss the most work of, any other type of employee. There's like a really high rate of missing work. So there are all kinds of ways that it's depleting the economy and depleting families and depleting people.
And the workforce, obviously, as you just mentioned. Now, Jane, there are several organizations for specific brain diseases such as Alzheimer's, MS, Parkinson, and epilepsy. Do you work with any of them?
Yes, we work with all of them. Our major research partner is the American Academy of Neurology, which is our founder. Mm-hmm. And that's the world's biggest professional association of neurologists. So we have a great relationship wherein we ask their scientists to vet everything that we fund. And so that's perfect because anyone who funds the American Brain Foundation knows that the best brain trust in the world is deciding where the money goes. But then besides that, we have partnerships with all of the big brain disease organizations, including ALS, Alzheimer's, Heart Association, Epilepsy Foundation, National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Parkinson's Foundation, and more. And together, we fund, as partners, early career researchers, the innovative projects of new researchers who are coming, onto the field right now. And we're getting them sort of out of the locker room and on the field by giving them their first big grant to do research.
You're a greenhouse that is growing these young, vibrant people who may, because of just their newness to the field, have different approaches or look at things through a different lens that could possibly make a difference because they're not using what has been the tried and true methods. Is that a fair assessment?
That is. And the other thing we're doing is we're guaranteeing, so far our track record is 83% of them are able to get government funding, NIH funding, after they've had this first project funded by the American Brain Foundation.
That's tremendous.
We don't have enough researchers, and one of the reasons why is because it's hard to get traction and get a project that you can then bring to NIH and say, see, I have a track record, you should fund me. So with the Alzheimer's Association and the American Brain Foundation fund a early career researcher every year. The American Brain Foundation and Parkinson's Foundation fund one every year. So we have that relationship with all of the big brain disease organizations.
That's very interesting, Jane, and thank you really for sharing this very important information with us. Tell me, Jane, why should people donate to the American Brain Foundation?
Well, I think that by giving to the American Brain Foundation, you are funding world-class research across the entire spectrum of brain diseases and disorders. That way you can honor everyone that you've known with one of these diseases. Most of us know someone with one disease and someone else with another disease.
Yeah, indeed.
And that also we are working for breakthroughs that will cure many brain diseases. So we're funding across that whole spectrum, and we know that curing one means curing many. And so we're really looking at it in that holistic way. Dan, you've always been good at reminding us that the brain is the real organ.
Right.
I mean, it's the most important thing. Right now, we have a Valentine's campaign going on right now called My Heart Loves Your Brain. So I know everybody in your audience has some brain that they love, and I encourage them to make a donation in honor of that brain.
We are going to stress that. We really appreciate your being here, talking to us about the American Brain Foundation and your collaboration and work with the AAN, the American Neurological Academy.
So how can people make this donation, Jane?
They can go straight to www.americanbrainfoundation.org.
Great.
And press the donate button.
We're going to get them to press it, okay?
Okay, you do that.
Hopefully many.
Thank you so much.
Jane, our pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been great. Okay.
Thank you, Jane.
Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
We'll be back.
From negative to positive, it takes focus. It takes the Thank You, Dan Show with Alex.
Welcome back to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
Hey, Dan.
Hey,
we
Alex.
We have a very special guest today with us. Would you please introduce him?
Yes, we have Dr. Robert Griggs, who is the chair of the American Brain Foundation Advisory Committee, which I sit on the board of, and his specialty is neuromuscular diseases. Welcome, Dr. Griggs.
Thank you.
Welcome, Dr. Griggs.
Tell us something. When I think of, you know, neuromuscular diseases, I think of the Jerry Lewis telethon and muscular dystrophy, but it is so much more than that. Am I correct in that assumption?
That's right. There are probably something on the order of 200 or more neuromuscular diseases, all of which up until relatively recently were untreatable. They also have in common the fact that they cause progressive muscle weakness. As you mentioned, the Jerry Lewis telethon focused our attention on the boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And one of the exciting things at the present time is that we are beginning to, for the first time, to develop treatments for these neuromuscular diseases. And some of the treatments are already producing just dramatic benefit to patients.
When you say dramatic benefits for our audience, 5 years ago, was that possible, or 10 years ago? When did this start to really become a situation that you could see that the efforts and the research and the amount of money that was going into this was finally starting to shed a light and pay some dividends?
Well, I think over the past 5 to 10 years, the first signs of hope have developed, and within the past 3 years, one of the most dramatic breakthroughs that has ever taken place in all of neurology, not just in neuromuscular disease, is the development of treatment for a disease of babies called spinal muscular atrophy. Mm-hmm. This starts at birth or is present at birth, and until very recently, 100% of these babies passed away by the time before they reached their second year of life. And just within the past 3 years, there's been a breakthrough that means that with gene therapy, these babies are being rescued and are now developing virtually normally. And so this is an amazing discovery. And the one of the things that's important, and I don't want to get too far ahead of you, but just to point out that we recognize the fact that this treatment was a strategy. What the way it was done was with gene therapy is something that not only can treat this disease, but it looks like it can treat other diseases. And so that's one of the reasons the American Brain Foundation has focused on the, if we can cure one, we will make breakthroughs in many diseases at the same time. And here's an illustration that's been life-saving and one of the most dramatic things you could imagine.
That is definitely
unbelievable.
An incredible breakthrough, and will definitely, good reason to give us a lot of hope on that, right?
Absolutely.
And Dr. Griggs, I'm just curious. We are curious and would love to know what got you into neuromuscular disease and treating neuromuscular disease. Where did this interest spark from?
The reason that I think it's important is it looks at this point. We now know the causes of virtually all the neuromuscular diseases. This makes them an ideal target for developing treatment. And so the fact that we have made this breakthrough, and now babies are actually in the United States are receiving the diagnosis in the first few days of life by newborn screening, and then getting treated. This means that neuromuscular disease is really leading the charge on in terms of developing treatments for neurological diseases. And we can see that the things we're doing with the nerve and muscle diseases that are the diseases I deal with are going to pave the way for treatments in other diseases. And
yeah.
It's such an exciting time, and that's why I'm committed to raising this, helping raise the support for these diseases.
That's fabulous. I have a question. How are these newborns screened for the neuromuscular diseases?
Well, this newborn screening has been done for various diseases.
Yes.
for over 50 years. There were a few diseases that could be screened for. What is done is in almost all states in the country, well, in all states, they take blood from babies when they're born
to look
for diseases that have to be treated right away to make sure that they get the benefit of treatment.
Yes, I'm familiar with it. Is it the heel prick?
It's a heel. It's a heel prick.
Yes, exactly.
It's a little prick to the heel, and they take a number of spots of blood, and then it's amazing what can be done with this. And there are now something like 60 diseases could be recognized. The most recent one is spinal muscular atrophy, and in Rochester, New York, where I work, the babies are coming and receiving gene therapy already just over the past year.
So just explain to our audience, thank you very much, what does, in its most lowest common denominator stance, what does gene therapy mean so that anyone or layperson could understand it?
Well, it's easy to understand. It's actually a concept that's easy to understand in the form that's being used for this baby disease, because what they do is they take a virus that ordinarily would cause something like a cold and take out the part of the virus that would cause the cold symptoms and insert into it the gene to correct the disease. And then that's injected into the bloodstream, and they also take the virus and tag it with something that helps it to target, in this case, the very cells that are diseased in this baby disease. This means that the gene therapy is bringing a replacement gene that will correct the disease. And this is one of the most exciting examples of what is going to prove to be possible in other diseases.
That's amazing. I mean, it's almost like you're infecting them with good stuff.
Yeah, so we were able to put in a gene and take out. It doesn't make people sick, doesn't make the baby sick, and it goes straight to where it's supposed to go.
You can't ask for anything better than that.
Yeah, definitely. And if I remember correctly, I believe that you did say earlier that you now know the causes of neuromuscular diseases. And what would they be?
So there are basically two types of diseases, genetic ones and then ones that are acquired.
Oh.
Because of the breakthroughs in genetics, we now know the genetic cause of these diseases, and that prepares us to address their their defect or the defect that has been discovered by various strategies of gene therapy. This one I mentioned with the virus is not the only one. There are a number of other strategies for fixing, if you will, the genetic defect. And so there are already several diseases that are being treated, with many more to come with enough research and enough support.
So where thank you. So where do you see this type of gene therapy with neuromuscular diseases going over the next 3 to 5 years? And let's look out 10 years down the road. What kind of picture can you paint for us?
Well, the one with gene therapy that I mentioned that's used in the babies looks like there's preliminary data already being presented that shows that Jerry's kids, the young boys with muscular dystrophy, a gene therapy strategy replacing their the fact that they don't have the essential protein to develop normally and to have normal strength. There's a way of inserting that a form of that gene into the muscles through gene therapy, and the boys are actually now able to run, which they've never been able to do before. And it's not yet approved for use generally, but in research studies it's being done all over the country. And this is, I think, within the next year or two we're going to see that come online. And there are, as I mentioned, a number of other diseases in which the same strategy is going to be useful.
That's really incredible news.
It's great. When people ask, why does the Brain Foundation and why do people who tackle these diseases don't give up, when you have these type of breakthroughs, I got to ask, do people really feel satisfied knowing that they've made that type of a difference?
So the important thing here is that the American Brain Foundation is partnering with other disease-specific organizations, because our strategy is that if we cure one, we will cure many. And here, the babies I mentioned is an example. And we've, for example, partnered with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and they, along with us, funded a young person who is well on her way. This is a young woman funded jointly by the American Brain Foundation and the Muscular Dystrophy Association to addressing another form of muscular dystrophy. She's, in fact, been trained through the monies that were provided by the Muscular Dystrophy Association and the American Brain Foundation. And this is just one example of, there are well over 200 young people that the American Brain Foundation, working with the American Academy of Neurology, have funded to get their research career up and going. And these are the best and the brightest, and these are the young people that are going to cure neurological diseases in the next 5 to 10 years.
So what you're saying, if I'm not mistaken, is that the future looks very promising.
The future is amazingly positive, and you pitched the ball to me, and because I'm interested in neuromuscular diseases, I've talked about that, but the research advisory committee that I chair is very interested in working on developing major breakthrough type of research for diseases such as Lewy body dementia, partnering with other groups interested in that, partnering with Michael J. Fox, partnering with the Alzheimer's Association, other to do similar exciting work to what's happening in neuromuscular disease.
And what would you say to someone like a young person going into the field? Why should they get involved?
Well, that's easy. I've been training people to go into research on finding new treatments for neurological diseases for the past 30 years, and it is absolutely amazing the work that these people are doing. And so I say this is such an exciting time. At one time, neurological diseases were largely untreatable. That has changed, and over the next decade, we're going to see other diseases falling to research and being treated.
Well, we sure hope so, because you know what? It is terrible to see people suffer the way they have been. And, you know, we hope that there is a better way for people to, you know, go through this journey and, you know, have a cure, you know, hopefully sooner than later, or for many of these diseases, at least, Dr. Griggs. Dr. Griggs, why should people donate to the American Brain Foundation?
Well, because the monies they give will go directly to research looking to find treatments for neurological diseases. That's mm-hmm. the focus of the American Brain Foundation. We want to train young people to develop the next treatments, and we want to fund research by the best and the brightest researchers that will look for cures for one disease that may help cure others. And we partner with other organizations, and we think what we do has a multiplying effect on the results on the donations that people make.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And please tell our listeners how they can donate.
Yes, they should. If they go to American Brain Foundation on the website, they can make donations there. Opportunities there to fund young people's research projects, as well as opportunities to fund major research projects.
That's great.
Well, you nailed it. I mean, cure one, cure many means a lot to the ABF, the American Brain Foundation, and to
your mantra,
the Brain Foundation's mantra. But to have you on and to hear such exciting, groundbreaking news about the differences that you know, gene therapy has made and what you see down the road. I'm stunned and pleasantly thrilled to have you on the show, Dr. Griggs.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Griggs.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
We'll be back.
A good life starts at the top. A good life starts with the Thank You, Dan Show with Alex.
Welcome back to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
Dan, we have another very special guest with us today.
Let me tell you something. This guy is amazing. We're both on the board of the American Brain Foundation, and I have not ever sat in a meeting with him where when he speaks, it's joyous. he makes science and information joyous. So it's so, you know, so great to have Dr. Joe Servin here.
Dr. Servin, welcome.
Thank you so much, both to you, Dan, and Alex, and let me know. It's just joyful
Thank
to
you.
Be with both of you on speaking to you both today.
We are so happy to talk to you today. So, Dr. Servin, you are on the board of directors of the American Brain Foundation, and you also work at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I've been within the Mayo system for many years and always have very much enjoyed being able to care for patients within that system.
Well, you know, I'm just going to digress for one quick second. I used to live in Atlantic Beach in Jacksonville. So that's where you are?
Yes.
Yeah, I lived 18th Street down right before you get to right past the Well, you know, you got Atlantic Beach, and then the next beach over is
Neptune.
So, yeah, and I used to live at the Sea Turtle. So, we never talked about this, but, you know, I mean, we're not here to go down memory lane. But now I love you even more, you know.
I did not know that this is no wonder we all see eye to eye. Yes, I'm living there now, and both my wife and I absolutely love it.
Oh, yeah, I was the general the general sales manager for WAWS down there. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're kidding.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
Lots of stories, Dr. Servin.
Lots of stories.
I think we'll be having a separate show on that part right here.
Absolutely. But the story today is one of your service, your expertise, your intellectual and medical prowess dealing with the brain.
And Dr. Servin, you specialize, your expertise is epilepsy. Can you explain to us and the listener more about what epilepsy really is?
You bet. You know, epilepsy, the best way to think about it is that It is a condition in which a person has repeated uncontrolled seizures. And a seizure is an abnormal electrical discharge of the brain. So you have extra electricity that you don't really need. And that is, epilepsy is a condition of having these seizures where the person doesn't know they're coming on, and it can present in many ways where they can have the big seizure that most people think about where they fall and they lose consciousness, or it can present very quietly where they're staring or having a problem with moving their hand or a tremor or feeling. And so it can present a lot of different ways, but basically at the end of the day, it's having seizures that you don't anticipate.
And how does that happen?
It happens for so many different reasons. Literally, it can vary by how old you are. If you're very young, the most common reason is problems with an infection or low oxygen when they're giving birth. If you move into young adults, it's about head injuries and tumors. If you go to older adults, it's about strokes and even dementia, Alzheimer's, and things of that direction can all cause seizures. And that's why seizures is so difficult, because people tend to think of it at one age, but the truth is it's literally from birth to older age, and that is something that I think a lot of folks don't realize.
I agree with you.
Alex, I never thought of it like that.
No, I never thought of it like that. But also, the one thing I know about seizures is that they can be very scary, and, you know, especially for people who are not familiar with them, they don't really know how to react around a person who is experiencing a seizure.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I remember...
you've been going through this.
But you know what? I have to say this to Dr. Servin. I remember playing football, and one of the tackles had an epileptic seizure. And no one knew what it was, but he stood up while we were in our stances, and he got clobbered because we didn't know. And then we realized that it wasn't that he had a false start as a lineman. It was that he was going through a seizure, and it imprinted on my brain till this day. I can still see that guy move and get hit, and at the same time not realizing that he was sick. You know, it wasn't like he made a mistake, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's hard to tell, right?
Exactly. And that's the problem. I think most people think that it's these full-blown events. They're everyone's so accustomed to, like, this idea that they're foaming at the mouth, that they're biting their tongue. But the truth is, they can present in so many different ways depending on what part of the brain is affected. And as you both stated, people get really scared because no one knows what to do, and no one knows what to do.
Yeah, that's true.
And I can tell you on the second occasion, more close to home, the first time that my wife had a seizure, it was the most gut-wrenching thing I'd ever experience.
I remember you calling me. Yeah. Not even calling me, you texted me.
Yeah, I mean, she let out a blood-curdling scream that I can only tell you shook me to the bones, and we were going through a snowstorm.
Oh, my goodness.
And then her eyes rolled back, and it was like she was possessed. And then I guess... Maybe you can tell me. It was almost like she was dead for a couple of seconds.
Yeah, a lot of times. So it's almost like at the end, I kind of liken it to, like, you know, a computer when it freezes. You're not processing. You're pressing all the buttons. Everything is just, like, showing up all these. Everything's going on in front of you, and you're just trying to find a way to reset. And that it can look like someone is dying. It can look like they're losing oxygen or not breathing. And as a result, you know, that's where you get all the reactions. And that's why it's just one of those things that people need to be aware of for 2 points. Number one, that there's just a few things you need to do. And the second thing is when to know how to get help when someone is having one of these things, should you be in a situation like you just described where you're witnessing this.
So what should somebody do in this situation, Dr. Servin?
Yeah, absolutely. So what there is what we call seizure first aid, and it's super easy. The first thing is just make sure that wherever the person is, that they can't get hurt. That if they're around something dangerous, then move them to a place that isn't so dangerous. Make sure that whatever sharp or scary that could cause an injury is out of the way. The second thing is making sure that they're kind of lay them on their side because that helps breathing recover faster.
Mm-hmm.
The other big piece of advice is never stick something into someone's mouth.
Oh,
good
yes.
to know.
Yeah, because you could lose teeth or you could
absolutely.
You know, get bitten from that. And so those are the elements. And if the seizure doesn't seem to be improving after 2 minutes or so, or if it's going past 5 minutes, excuse me, that's when you need to get help. That's when a 911 and things of that sort. But the person's recovering, it's just all a matter of just letting it pass and making sure that if they have a history of seizures, they take medication. If they don't have a history, then they probably need to get to an emergency room.
That is such helpful advice, Dr. Servin. We really thank you for sharing that. Now, you are a doctor who wears many hats. You are also the editor of the Spanish edition of Brain and Life magazine. What kind of messages about the brain disease do you want to send to Latinos?
Well, you know, that's very important. My background is Cuban, even though I may not sound it, because I was the first of my family born in the U.S. But
you sound like you're from Massachusetts.
I love it. I love Massachusetts too. I might add. but having said that, one of the messages that I'm involved when it comes to the Brain and Life in Espanol is the fact that a lot of people, a lot of Latinos out there, especially those that don't speak the language, they don't have a lot of resources available that is able to convey, well, this conversation for that matter in Spanish or this information in Spanish so that everyone has accessibility to it. And so the biggest message is, number one, we're here for you. We're trying to cover all things neurology, all things brain, all things spinal cord, so that we can give that information in Spanish in a way that they appreciate it. And the second thing is, just like I tell anyone who spoke English, there's a lot of great stuff happening that is exciting and that brings a lot of hope. And I guess that's my biggest message of all.
Yes, that's what we all want to hear, Dr. Servin. Hope is an important message to all of us, and it keeps us going.
How can people who have any sort of epilepsy or situations like that reach the right sources? Is there some website or some, you know,
helpline
that's available?
Absolutely. There's lots of resources for it. I would say everything from we have lots of resources at Brain and Life where they have different diseases that you could click on and you
right.
can look up epilepsy. You can go epilepsy.com. I used to work with them. That's out of the Epilepsy Foundation, and they do a very nice job of laying out information. The NIH, my employer, Mayo Clinic, has a nice site. Point is, there's lots of places
right.
that you can find this information, and all of it will be there to kind of really guide you and empower you to kind of make better decisions about what care you need and what's available.
Dr. Servin, you are, where I'm from, we call you a mensch. You're amazing, and we're so glad to have you. And we want to get you back. Anything that's new or exciting in this field, please let us
yes,
know, and we'll have you
know.
Back on, okay?
Absolutely. I can't wait to do it and talk more Atlantic Beach with you.
We'll be talking about that definitely, okay?
Thank all you right, so much for your time, Dr. Servin, and for sharing all this good advice.
You got it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You bye-bye.
Both. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
We'll be back.
Don't wait to make your life better. Get started with the Thank You, Dan Show with Alex.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
Alex, we have a man who has just done some remarkable things, and I'm very proud to have him on our show. He just assumed the top spot on the board of directors at the American Brain Foundation.
Congratulations.
This is Dr. David Dodick. Doctor, it's so great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here, Dan and Alex. It's a pleasure.
Welcome, thanks, Dr. Dodick.
Let me ask you a quick question. You know, what made you want to become a neurologist?
Well, that's a great question. You know, to be quite honest with you, when I started medical school, I was pretty much convinced that I was going to become a cardiologist. And when I took a neuroanatomy course, I was just fascinated by the anatomy and by the brain and by neuroscience in general, and how it was how we knew so little about the brain. And so that it fascinated me. And then I was inspired by a neurologist that I worked with. He was absolutely brilliant. And he basically would make diagnoses, as many neurologists do, with his hands and his brain, based on a physical and a neurological examination. So to be able to see that sort of Sherlock Holmes type of deductive and analytical reasoning, and be able to figure out what's going on with a patient, just by taking a careful history, doing a neurological examination, and understanding the intricacies of the brain, it just inspired and fascinated me. And ever since that day, I decided I was going to be a neurologist, and I never looked back.
You know, it's amazing how one door
that's
opens.
That's a fascinating story,
yeah.
Yeah,
isn't that something?
Exactly. And now, Dr. Dodick, you are at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and you are the director of both their headache and concussion programs.
Yes.
Tell us, would you share with us, please, what is giving you hope that we can solve this riddle of headaches and find better treatments for concussions?
You know, when I got involved in this field, there was basically one treatment that was approved for the treatment of migraine, which is the most common primary headache disorder that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fast forward now almost 30 years, we've now had five new medications become available just over the past year. So we used to think of migraine as a problem that with dilated and painful blood vessels. Now that's completely been flipped on its head. We now know that migraine is a neurological disorder that begins in the brain. We've worked out the anatomy, and with quite a bit of precision, we've worked out at a microscopic level what's happening in the brain and what's happening in the nerves during a migraine attack. And when you can understand at a precise molecular level what's happening, that opens up new targets for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's happened. So we've moved from it being a blood vessel disorder to a nerve problem, a brain problem. We've identified several key high-profile targets. We've gone after them. And now we've got a plethora of new treatments that have become available that are specific for the problem. And so it's just been a boon for the field. And that's great for patients because, you know, for migraine, for example, there are 40 million people in the United States and almost 1 billion worldwide.
Wow.
That suffer with migraine. And it's, according to the World Health Organization, for those between the ages of 15 and 50, it's the most disabling disease.
Yeah.
So it's a huge unmet treatment need that we've been able to fulfill in many patients, and it's very gratifying.
That's amazing. I would never think, I mean, you just said that there are 1 billion people on this planet that suffer from severe headaches. And what's the impact of that in their daily lives?
Well, the impact is profound. As a, you know, for young people between 15 and 50, they lose more years of life due to disability than any other medical illness on the planet.
Amazing.
That's profound.
I was not aware of that at all,
no,
to be honest.
And for those, you know, when you take any age, next to stroke, it's the single most disabling neurological disease in the world. So
amazing.
People underestimate how profound the impact can be. I just finished seeing a patient, 19 years old, from Oklahoma, and she's now had to drop out of college, hopefully temporarily, because the impact is that profound. And so this is what I see
it's
every
terrifying.
Day. I see kids and young adults whose lives are disrupted. You know, they're trying to build families, they're trying to build careers, they're trying to get an education,
yeah.
And their lives are completely turned upside down.
Yeah.
So the impact is profound, it's underestimated. And fortunately, we now have new tools to be able to make a difference in these people's lives.
And you know what's interesting, too, Doctor, is now that you're talking about it, it's really not that much talked about. I mean, we don't talk about headaches, and people, yeah, every now and again you talk to somebody, they complain about headaches or migraines, but it's not really anything that's very much talked about in the media, to my knowledge, and we don't really know that much about it.
No, no, and that's, you know, headache has become kind of a euphemism, Alex, for anything in the anything in our lives that's a nuisance, right?
Yes, this is true.
You're a pain in a headache.
Yeah.
It's just
you're giving me a headache, right?
Or, you know, yeah. Tax time is, it's such a headache, right? So it's become
yes.
a euphemism for everything that's just a nuisance and an annoyance.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, that's the way, unfortunately, many of these patients are treated because, you know, unless you're adequately schooled in medical school and in residency as to the science that underlies this and the treatments that are available, you know, doctors like, you know, we like to help people. And if we feel like we can't help someone, we kind of want to run in the opposite direction. Well, now it's a different matter. And now with these new treatments available, patients really need to stand up for themselves. And doctors and all medical providers need to pay attention to these people because if you can change a person's life, and you have the tools to do that, I can't understand why one wouldn't be excited with the opportunity to do just that, because that's why we do what we do.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
we're both in sync with that understanding. You've taken on a new role. I mean, in addition to your, you know, groundbreaking work with the Mayo Clinic, you are now the chair of the board of the American Brain Foundation. How did that happen, and why did you do it?
And congratulations.
And congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege and it's a singular honor for me. You know, a funny story, but back in 1991, I got my first research grant from the American Brain Foundation. Isn't it ironic that
one day
it is
here? This comes full circle, and I'm now the chair of the foundation that got my career started.
You're
good
paying
for you.
It forward.
Good
I'm
for you.
It forward. And so that's one of the reasons why I decided to do this, because in large part, that's responsible, that gift, that donation, that mm-hmm. research grant is responsible for kickstarting my career. That, and, you know, I think we can become the largest charitable organization for the brain in the world, not just in the United States. And I think, you know, over the next few years, I hope to put us on a path where we can build a brand that becomes a household name as a champion for brain disease research and as a trusted steward of funds that are dedicated for brain research. If not us, then who? Because we happen to have as our partner the American Academy of Neurology that really houses the world's brain trust.
With 36,000 members, I believe, correct?
Exactly. So we have all of the most brilliant minds in the field as our partners. So who better to vet and any funding that comes in? I know I would have confidence that if I were providing money for brain research, that if that money is being vetted and distributed by the nation and the world's leading neuroscientists, I have confidence that money is being spent on research that is likely to translate into treatment advances for patients.
That's
yeah,
amazing.
That's absolutely true.
Tell us, Doctor, how can people donate to the organization?
You know, it's AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Right on our website, there's a donate button there, and so we make it very easy for people to give. And what's different about the American Brain Foundation, not only that, you know, we have that such a valuable partner in the American Academy of Neurology and all the neuroscientists, but we cover the spectrum of brain diseases. You know, mm-hmm. as someone who specializes in concussion and specializes in migraine, you know, I belong to different organizations and subspecialty societies that focus on those. But the American Brain Foundation really focuses on all neurological diseases. And I think that's important because the mantra of the Brain Foundation is cure one and cure many. And what that means is that when we understand the biological underpinnings of one disease, that will inevitably allow us to translate treatment advances for many other diseases.
That's amazing.
Indeed.
Absolutely. You know,
yeah.
we're very happy to have you. What I really would love to do is have you on at another time to talk about the impact of concussions and insult to the brain. And but we really want to thank you so much for being on the show today and
taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, Dan and Alex. It was great to be with you. I admire what you do. I'm inspired by what you do, and I can't wait to be on again with you both.
Don't worry. We'll call.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. David Dedek.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
What an inspiring evening. You're listening to the Thank You, Dan.
And Alex Show.
See you next time.